You're listening to the Pandemic Podcast. We equip you to live the most real life possible in the face of today's crises. My name is Matt Bodker, and I'm joined with not one, but two good friends, Dr. Stephen Kissler, an epidemiologist at the Harvard School of Public Health, and Dr. Mark Kissler, a doctor at the University of Colorado. Hello, you two. How is it going? Mark, good to see you, buddy.
Thanks. Yeah, it's good to be back.
It is. It's good to have you back. It's good to have you back. And Stephen, good to see you as always.
Hey.
Hey, you guys, min a few words, which is usually not the best people to select for a podcast.
But for a podcast, right. Yeah, one of the many reasons we need you, Matt.
It's awesome. Anyway, I'm not even going to go there. But anyway, nonetheless, it's great to have you guys. There's a lot to talk about. I mean, some of it's kind of the same old stuff from last week. It's the Delta and all this. It's kind of frightening stuff of the surge and all these infections. But I think we're going to start with Mark in just a couple of minutes, because since we haven't had him for a few weeks, and Mark, you just got off the COVID rounds. So I think you have a pretty unique perspective that we haven't been able to give to our listeners for quite a few weeks, if not months, because even when you were back with us a few weeks ago, I don't think you were on the COVID team at that point in time. And so maybe you were, I don't remember. So we'll talk about that in just a second, but before we get started, just a couple small normal things. If you can support us, we greatly appreciate that. Patreon.com/pandemicpodcast. As little as $5 a month goes a long way. Or just a one-time donation. Venmo, PayPal. Those are all in the show notes. You can get them right there. And please, please leave a review. We like them. It encourages us. It keeps us going. We like to read them ourselves, and we like to read them on the podcast as well. So please do that if you can. And if you want to reach out to us, let us know how you are doing. If you have questions for us, matt@livingthereal.com. And I promise to forward those on to Mark and Stephen. Okay, so let's get going. Mark, I want to give you the floor right away, because this is our second take, because we've had some technical issues. It's a kind of
big surprise there.
Really surprised whenever we have Mark on.
Our chronic listeners are going to be shocked.
Oh, man. It becomes complicated. So, Mark, why don't you go ahead and just kind of tell us what's been going on at the hospital and how that's been kind of how you've been dealing with that psychologically, emotionally, and just as a team in the hospital as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think I have a lot of thoughts. It was quite a week, and I'm sensitive to the fact that, you know, there's so many things sort of swirling around, you know, as I leave the COVID team this week. There's a little bit of disappointment and a little bit of frustration. I really don't want our narrative on this show, or our narrative, you know, in general, to be one of perpetual crisis, you know, like here comes another crisis. Here comes this, here's what you need to worry about. Everybody's got to stay super safe. You know, that's not, and has never really been the goal of, you know, what I want to communicate. Ideally, we're just talking about what's going on, but I have to say, you know, here we are, you know, August, 2021, and we're starting to see some of the same patterns that we were seeing last fall, with some very distinct differences. And the biggest difference, and I think the thing that, if I'm completely honest, is really affecting sort of morale and the sense of what we're doing in the hospital, is that a significant portion of the morbidity that we're seeing, a significant portion of the severe disease, feels preventable at this point in a way that it didn't earlier in the pandemic. And, you know, and I think I'm, you know, as we've talked about it, you know, I am sensitive to, and want to be sensitive to, sort of all the reasons why there's complexity, hesitancy around these vaccines. And at the same time, the subjective experience of being in the hospital and seeing preventable disease over and over and over again, and seeing it begin to increase, you know, being on the COVID team a month ago and having us have a real low, you know, slump in patients, feeling like we're getting back into the communities. And then to feel right now as if we might be on the verge of, you know, needing to do some distancing again in the communities, you know, this and that, and perpetually, you know, having the same conversations over and over and over again. And while there's different variations, you know, different reasons for not getting the vaccine, and different that what I'm wishing for is sort of an internal consistency amongst those narratives. And it's just not, there's just a tremendous amount of fragmentation that seems to me to be really expressing at the core what is kind of this feeling, you know, this uneasiness that I'm not, at least in what I've encountered, hasn't borne up to the kind of rational scrutiny that I would hope, you know, to make a really serious decision that affects one's own health, one's family's health, and the community's health. Does that make sense? Am I talking around this too much? At the end of the day, I'm frustrated. I'm tired. And so are a lot of my colleagues. And I don't think that it's just frustration at other people, you know, just frustration at people who don't have the vaccine. It's a little bit of frustration at the situation and seeing this, you know, yet again, you know, here we are 18 months in.
Yeah.
And but also feeling a little bit like puzzlement is how do we get some more traction? You know, how do we get a little bit more of this conversation out to communities who need it? Because it, in some ways, it feels like maybe we're just talking to people who agree.
Yeah, I'm glad to bring this up, Mark, 'cause I don't even know how to really, you know, talk about this without, you know, I know everybody has their own way they're processing these things. But throwing to you, Stephen, like, I would imagine this is somewhat of a discussion piece among your colleagues and what's going on. Like, how do we get the message out of, or what's broken and what's going on, by which, you know, it seems so obvious now with well over 90% of the people coming to the hospital being unvaccinated. It's like, oh, that's just a case for itself, for your own self-preservation. You know, you just want to, compared to the, you know, the side effects of getting vaccinated, it's not even close. So like, is there a talk about among you guys right now of like, what on earth do we do to help people?
Yeah.
See the safety of it.
I mean, it's such a, complex and nuanced issue. I mean, I know that a number of months ago, we had one of Mark's colleagues on who's an expert in vaccine hesitancy. So there are, you know, people who devote their entire research careers to understanding exactly this phenomenon. But I mean, as I think Mark was speaking about as well, that this is also really a moving target. And the thing that constitutes vaccine hesitancy can look different in different places, at different times, in different people, depending on the vaccine, depending on the political climate, depending on, you know, all sorts of different things, depending on the perception of risk. And so that makes it really hard to study and to understand vaccine hesitancy as such. I think that there are some common themes that run throughout these different aspects of vaccine hesitancy that have, you know, really been a consistent part of the public health dialogue over the last, you know, even decades. But really, I mean, the way that vaccine hesitancy looks has changed. The people who are prone to vaccine hesitancy is it to some degree shifted in some ways. And so, I mean, just for an example, you know, one of the big issues with vaccine hesitancy for the measles vaccine prior to the COVID pandemic was generally sort of very well off families in California who weren't vaccinating their kids. And it was sort of associated with, you know, almost this, there sort of, if we're looking at the political spectrum, it was sort of on the far left in some sense, if we're speaking in very broad strokes, that like vaccine hesitancy was the greatest problem. And that seems to sort of be shifting and swaying as time goes. And I think really what that's getting to is that the political spectrum is really not a good yardstick for measuring whether or not a person is going to be vaccine hesitant. And I think that's one of my big frustrations about the conversation right now, is that it sort of digs into this broader discussion about what does it mean to be vaccine hesitant, and this lens that we seem to apply to everything about left and right, red and blue, whatever, actually just doesn't seem to hold up here totally. There are trends for sure, but those trends aren't consistent over time. And so there's something else going on here that we really need to understand that doesn't just boil down to political preference. And so I think that's the thing that is interesting to me. And that's the thing that still remains a big mystery. It would be potentially interesting to, you know, talk about some of the specific elements of vaccine hesitancy that we've talked about, or, you know, that I've heard arise, that include, you know, the ethics of receiving the vaccine, the ethics about the ways in which it was developed and produced, the safety profile, as well as, you know, different degrees of misinformation about past vaccines and their effects on a person's long-term health and these kinds of things. So I think there are all of these different sort of aspects to it. And it might be valuable at some point to dig into each of those objections at some point. But I think also one of the things that Mark was talking about is that that can be valuable, but I also don't know if that's the root issue here. I think that there's something about ticking off each of these arguments that still wouldn't necessarily be sufficient to convince a person who is vaccine hesitant to then receive a vaccine. So there's something even deeper going on here that I don't claim to understand. Certainly people are thinking a lot about, but it would be interesting to discuss with you guys.
Yeah. And I think, you know, thank you. I would love to hear and just kind of sit in on an episode where we go through some of the major, you know, I know that there's been some of this done in the broader media too, about like engaging in dialogue with people who haven't gotten the vaccine and what are their reasons. And there's actually a lot of different reasons and a lot of different motivations, and kind of going through maybe some of the big ones of that and discussing, because I think those affect different people in our communities and families, you know, all over the board. On the other hand, I don't want to harp too much on some level. I think that this vaccine hesitancy issue is maybe a second layer too, that there's underneath that, there's a bigger conversation around trust of the medical, you know, system and like what's going on there. And I think there's some definitely some valid critiques about the way that, you know, medicine has seen to overreach in certain ways, you know, with certain communities and different historical locations. And I think there's a lot of a feeling of that. You know, I've read some interesting articles that are coming out now about, they're sort of framing the pandemic. And what I'm leading up to here is the sense that, you know, I think we can focus on vaccine hesitancy as a phenomenon in itself. But I think there's another phenomenon that's nested within, which is what do we think about the relationship between medicine, science, society, you know, and culture? That's a very big question, right? But I've seen some interesting articles that have sort of framed the shutdowns of the last year and recommendations of public health experts as a certain sort of power grab, you know, that there's this medical industrial machine that saw the pandemic as a chance to exert control over society, or to like broaden, you know, the reach of these forces that want, I don't know exactly understand what these hidden motivations are that people are feeling. And it seems to paint medicine and, you know, and science as a little bit more organized than I think it really is. And so I do agree. I mean, I think there are ways that medicine can be, you know, I like the word totalizing. Are you familiar with that term or that idea that there are ways of thinking about kind of medicine and science that sort of take all elements of human existence and put it under this frame. And in that way, they kind of flatten it, you know? Like, I think there's good, you know, we've got to be able to think outside of, you know, purely kind of a utilitarian calculus of like what's going to give the most number of life years. You know, there's other goods. We've talked about this a million times, right? And there's ways that a purely kind of medical scientific frame might flatten other elements of human existence and, you know, and goodness, relationship, things like that. But I'm not convinced that this pandemic to me seems to be a different case. You know, a lot of people, I think, are framing this as like, this is a lot more of the same, and that there's this kind of systematic overreach. And from the inside, that's not how it feels, you know? And it's hard for me to not, at this point, start to take some of those arguments personally. It's hard for me to not start to feel as if this, you know, this perpetual, like, you know, oh, they, you know, big government, big medicine, they want us, they want to control us, they want to take away our freedoms, you know, when I and my colleagues have been putting our families at risk for the last 18 months, you know, and not to be overdramatic, and, you know, particularly at the beginning of the pandemic, when we didn't have a clue about what was going on, but we knew that this was real. You know, and that we're, you know, and we're still engaging in the same thing. And so much of this is preventable, you know. It's hard for me to not take some of these arguments deeply personally, you know, and say, that's not what's going on here. You know, this is not a big power grab. This is a deep misunderstanding about what we're trying to do. And it's a misunderstanding that has effects on people's lives. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, this is, I'm glad you're saying this, Mark, because I've been feeling for you and for doctors and nurses all around the country. I remember it kind of goes back to, at least for me, one of my memories is like maybe last April, or when we were talking, I was talking to a friend of mine who was dismissing hospitals being overloaded and saying, oh my gosh, I know all these people, these nurses, doctors, they're saying there's nothing going on in the hospitals. This is all just conspiracy theory. And, you know, Stephen, you broke it down for us to explain, like, this is the complexity of the situation where, like, you're right. Depending on what hospital you go in, it may be full and it may be not, but doesn't change the fact that there are a lot of hospitals being overrun and doctors and nurses being putting their lives at stake, being exhausted, can't even care for the patients that are non-COVID related. And it's tapping the system. I feel like it's kind of this whole thing all over again. And hearing your voice, Mark, I think I'm hoping it helps, like, to realize that there are real people, real doctors, real nurses in hospitals sacrificing their families to, and it's different, right? I mean, last fall it was scary and the future was unknown, but there was a lack of control in some sense. Now there's like really a large sense of advocacy and it's not being used, which makes it all the more like, kind of goes back to Abraham. He's talked about how if there's one thing we learned from this pandemic is that we hopefully will realize we're way more connected than we'd like to give credit for. And that anybody's decision to do something, not to make it great, but needs to have consideration of who it impacts. And I think that's been the greatest thing you guys have been doing for us and for me particularly about when it comes to the vaccine. It's not just my own health. It's a bigger picture that I have to put in consideration, right?
Yeah, it's amazing to me how much, and I don't know why I'm surprised at this, but I am, at how much this anecdotal evidence or this personal experience continues to matter for people. So I have, you know, I care for a lot of folks in the hospital who are like, man, if I only knew, if I had only known, you know, I would have gotten the vaccine. And it's just surprising to me because it's not as if this information is not available. And similarly, you know, there's the conversations around like, oh, well, now I'm going to take it seriously, or now I'm going to, you know, now I understand. I guess I'm not convinced that it needs to come to that point, that you need to experience it in your own body, in your own family, you know, and the shame of that, right, of course, is that who bore the brunt of so much of this early in the pandemic are these communities that are hidden away, that are not, you know, not as mainstreamed or, you know, or vulnerable in other ways. And now all of a sudden the realization is hitting communities that had been previously more sheltered from the effects of the pandemic. And it just seems to me that such a shame to not be able to enter into the experience, you know, the real experience of other people in our communities and change our behavior as a result of that, you know. And I recognize that there's so many layers, and I'm sure that I'm oversimplifying, and I'm speaking out of my own, you know, limited experience as well. And, you know, not arguing necessarily that it's more valid, et cetera, et cetera. But it's very hard. It's just very hard for me to dismiss what I've seen, you know, my own anecdotal evidence, what I've seen with my own eyes for the last 18 months. But I don't think that there's like some, I have privileged access in the sense that I work in a hospital, you know, but no, it's not a secret.
I'm speechless. I don't even know how, you know, where I've worked in the past and the hesitancies, and I can't explain it. I don't understand it. And it's frustrating to no end.
Yeah. And I don't want to, and I think maybe we can pivot a little bit, because I don't want to just give vent to my own, you know, but part of the reason that I wanted to be sure to come on today, though, you know, is just to speak a little bit out of the rawness of the experience of being on the wards yet again, you know, and really kind of attesting to this very significant difference in the morale and how it feels. And that I think is felt kind of across the board, at least, you know, in my conversations and just sort of the general air. And, you know, we take care of people all the time, very rightfully so, who all of us, you know, all of our diseases, every disease that you and I and everybody's going to get has some relationship to choices we've made, to, you know, our individual genetic makeup, where we grow up, and then things we do, you know, things we do to ourselves. That's, you know, that's just the fact of life. So it's not as if I, you know, think that anybody deserves different care, you know, as a result of choices they made. That's very fundamental, that it doesn't matter, you know, and that, but at the same time, I don't know, I can really sympathize in some ways with some of the doctors in, you know, in fiction that I've encountered in books, you know, over the years, who get this certain kind of world weary, and it's very pragmatic, you know, it's a very, like, and I recognize the limitations of a super pragmatic outlook, you know, because sometimes we need our idealists and we need our, you know, big idea thinkers and stuff. But man, I really sympathize with that, and just feeling,
you know, doing a slight pivot, but still on the same theme, like, given what's going on and what you've experienced, How have things changed for you, Mark? Like now living this new kind of surge scene at the hospital, clearly the idea of Lord have mercy, please get vaccinated. That's clearly at the forefront of your mind. Are there other things by which, you know, you're now, you're a family man, right? And you have kids going to school, and how have things been changing for you, if at all, as you see this new surge coming on for, has your lifestyle changed a little bit, or how is school in the interest of school coming along? How are things changing for you in that area?
Yeah. So you're kind of asking about how does this affect kids going back to school and things like that?
Yeah.
So we're getting our kids ready. My youngest is going back this week. He went back, and big news here is that he is no longer a napper at school. Oh. And so he was a napper previously, and now he's a worker. This is a Montessori thing. And which means that he cruises on through nap time and crashes hard when he gets home. Man. He was so tired.
Poor
he was
guy.
So tired last night. Yeah, I know. It's really cute. But we were fortunate, you know, in the sense that we were able to do a significant amount of in-person schools. I'm worried about how this school year is going to be. I think it might be a little bit of a disaster because of how prevalent this Delta variant and how transmissible it is. And so if we shut down classes every time somebody gets it, and I think, and this is another, you know, complexity, because if for the families who are able to be vaccinated, having an index case within the classroom is not that huge of a deal necessarily. And I'm wondering if it's worth it to education and continuity to shut down an entire classroom of kids. You know what I mean? I think there's conversation. I'm not the public health expert in the room here, so I'm not going to go out. But at the same time, it feels a little bit from an educational standpoint. You know, we saw the ways that educational disparities widened massively over the course of the last year. And so then going into another school year and feeling like we might be lining up for the same thing again is a little bit daunting. And so, you know, I felt very, very fortunate both about with our school community and our ability to kind of shuffle and move things around and, you know, help our kids kind of continue to do stuff. But not everybody has that flexibility. A lot of people are working two jobs at this school. You know, a lot of families at the school we go to have a lot of just different constraints, and shutting down school and keeping kids home is a very different prospect for them. And so yet again, you know, here we are at another kind of semi-reversible or something we have control over in terms of how do we protect communities from school-related exposures. And I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen, you know.
And I mean, I'm curious for you, Mark, and then we can ask questions for Stephen as well, but I'm sure parents are out there are worried in some level as well of like taking their kids and going to school with a Delta. With your experience, I think it's good just to hear from you, Mark, of like, how are you feeling with that and taking your kids to school? And
I don't know. It's always been much on my mind this year. And I think even though we know that the severe disease in young kids is not near what it is in adults, it's always been something that has, I just have wanted to be, you know, extra careful about. And I've seen news articles about, like, you know, now children's hospitals are seeing more cases, and we're seeing a lot more kids getting it, coming down with it. I don't know. And this is another instance where I really don't want to be alarmist and say like, oh, it's a crisis, we got to stop everything, you know, because kids are getting sick now. And, you know, here we are and the world's on fire. And but at the same time, I think, you know, it makes us think, you know, and think about ways that our actions are just here, you know, here they are affecting real people again.
Yep.
I don't think, you know, I don't know. I'd be interested to hear Stephen's opinion on, you know, if kind of what this means in terms of overall burden of disease and, you know, in pediatric populations and things like that. On the whole, I don't feel panicked about Delta and my kids. You know, I don't feel as if it materially changes a lot of things. You know, I think that some common sense masking here and there, you know, common sense kind of being judicious about where we go and what we do, but not being, you know, over scrupulous about it, that's going to be the state of our lives through much of 2023, if we believe what the gentleman on the left here has written, you know, in the past. And so that's fine. You know, that's fine to me. I'm more concerned, I think, about some of these bigger picture implications and the ways that we might react and overreact to increasing cases in different pockets among kids. So,
yep.
Steve, do you have anything to say about that? Of like, I mean, here's the thing. Like, I see the same thing, increased hospitalization with children, this kind of stuff. And like all of our podcast episodes, I feel like, Steven, you can give insight to this, but it's probably just complicated because there's so many nuances to different culture now. We have vaccinated parents with unvaccinated children dragging their children to places probably. It's summer. It's a radically different playing field than last August, like radically. So seeing 48% of children, you know, maybe getting infected of those who are being infected, not hospitalized, but just infected. I'd imagine it's the complexity of this mixed bag of vaccinated, unvaccinated in summertime, right? Or
yeah, exactly. As far as we can tell, that's the story. It's really interesting because many of my colleagues are sort of split on, you know, what we should be doing about schools and to what extent we can safely reopen them. I tend to fall in line more with the ones who sort of seem to be also in line with what Mark was saying, which is that there are at this point some very common sense measures that we can take to keep schools pretty safe. Certainly the risk of severe acute disease in young kids is much lower than it is for adults. And that is not to minimize the fact that there are absolutely risks to kids associated with this virus, for sure. And I think we need to remain mindful of those, but the situation now is different than it was 6-12 months ago. A case no longer means the same thing that it did then because vaccination rates are much higher. The odds that a kid will spread disease to older family members is lower, assuming that those people are vaccinated. And so I think that we're really, you know, the playing field is really shifting, layered on top of the fact that, you know, we know a lot more about masking. We know a lot more about ventilation and the importance of that. We have a much better sense of sort of how to control COVID in these situations. So, and as Mark was saying, you know, closing schools is a massive disruption. It's, you know, there are also public health implications for that too, that are very long lasting in the sense of more vulnerable populations falling behind in their education, of adults who are working multiple jobs, not being able to take care of their kids. You know, there are huge, huge issues here that we should be addressing on the side as well. You know, we should be thinking about, you know, how do we provide childcare for families who need it, who can't afford it. You know, these things are also public health issues that we need to be thinking about. But in the meantime, you know, we don't have those structures in place. And so I think that it's a complex landscape, but I do think that, you know, shutting everything down for a single case in a school probably doesn't make sense anymore. If there's a major outbreak, then we can maybe start thinking about that for sure. But I think that, you know, schooling is so incredibly important. And I think that we do know how to really improve our odds at keeping that safe, that we can just sort of move forward, even in the context of Delta. One last sort of point that I wanted to add to that is, you know, you were talking about rising hospitalizations in young kids, and there's been a lot of talk about, you know, does this mean that the virus is more severe for young kids? It's really hard to disentangle, but the same narrative was arising with the Alpha variant, B.1.1.7, earlier too. And as far as I can tell, all of the patterns are consistent with it just being more infectious across the board. And so when that happens, you're going to expect to see more infections across all populations. But now, with the differential in vaccination between older kids, you know, between older adults and young kids who aren't vaccinated, we expect the relative proportion of people who end up in the hospital with young kids to rise. And we expect the overall number to rise just because it's so much more infectious. So everything that I'm seeing is consistent with just the Delta being more infectious and not necessarily being like targeting kids particularly. And so I think that's all consistent with what Mark was saying too, is that, you know, it's worth still being, you know, wearing masks in grocery stores and sort of being mindful of how many people we're seeing and how much time we're spending indoors with other people. The Delta is more infectious. And I think that that's really the bottom line, is that we're just dealing with the virus. That's the same thing we've been dealing with. It is more transmissible for sure, and that causes issues, but not time to panic about it suddenly, you know, changing its entire age profile in terms of who it's infecting and who it's causing more severe disease in, I think.
Yeah, and go back to Mark's point, and just shows you the complexity of all this. You know, every day I'm in the news looking at what's the highlights. What can we talk about this week? What's going on? And I see these highlights of, like, you know, 6-year-old, 7-year-old hospitalized, right? I'll get these like headlines, right? And it's even hard for me to be like, oh, is that propaganda? Or is that a real, like, you know what I mean? Like, are you trying to make it worse than it is to get people to prepare them to take the, and so what I, you know, there's some level of sympathy of those people who also those headlines of like, oh, you know, 50 year old man regrets not getting vaccine. He's in the ICU. It's a headline. It's powerful. But I wonder sometimes like, okay, why is that there? Is it there to persuade people? You know, is it an outlier? It just makes things complicated, right? And it's like, it makes it, then I feel like it's a political issue and I'm on this side of the pandemic. Like I'm on this side. Like, and so it's just, the media makes it really hard, even messes with my head. This is why I have to be with you guys every Monday or Tuesday now, so I can get clear. So one thing I want to transition to, because I think this is really related, and this is like miscommunication, misunderstanding. I just want to go straight to this because it's the Rogan show, right? Where is it at here? Joe Rogan is getting this completely wrong is the title. I'll put this in the show notes. It says the scientist who conducted the vaccine study. So I want to give the floor to you, Stephen, because you just saw a talk with this Reed fellow who Rogan took. It's like a 2015 vaccine study. And basically, to put it in a quick synopsis for all those who are listening who haven't read or listened to Joe Rogan, Joe Rogan used this vaccine study to suggest that those who are getting the vaccine may be actually harboring environments for the vaccine to create multiple variants and make our life in the end worse, right? That's the conclusion that Joe Rogan is making from this vaccine study. The scientist himself says Joe Rogan got all wrong. Steven, you want to help give us some clarification of what whatever this study was and what's the real implication, how it's related or unrelated to the COVID vaccines?
Yeah, so this study was by a colleague named Andrew Reed, and who's very highly respected, you know, in the field, but also by me personally. I think he's done really great work, and he's very clear-eyed about the findings of his studies. And I think that actually I was recently in a workshop in which he spoke about this exact study that Joe Rogan was talking about. And I think that was really exemplary of how he was able to dive into the nuance of this study. I mean, he was very clear about the fact that, so let's give some background to this study, right? So first of all, this is a study that was done in chickens. Okay. And so chickens get infected with viruses like humans do. They have immune systems like we do. Their immune systems differ from ours. But they were looking at a vaccine that prevented severe disease and death from a virus that infects chickens. Now, critically, you know, they ran this study, they were looking at this vaccine, and they did find that concurrent with vaccination, some new variants of the virus emerged that were both more transmissible and I think slightly more clinically severe. I don't know if chickens have clinics, but the important thing about this is really two things. So first of all, the vaccine had no effect on transmission. So if you have a vaccine that can reduce the severity of illness and provides, you know, some protection against the progression of illness, but provides no protection against transmission, then sometimes you can get new variants that emerge that do some of these strange things. But the most important finding about all of this is that the vaccinated chickens were still protected against severe disease and illness, even from the variants. Even though their risk increased with the variants, that risk was still much lower than the risk that the chickens that were unvaccinated were facing. And so in some ways, that's very consistent with what we're seeing with COVID, is we are seeing new variants emerge. But still, the risk that vaccinated people face from these variants is much lower than the risk that unvaccinated people face from the variants. Now, there comes the issue of, is getting vaccinated driving the development of these variants? There have been a lot of sort of studies around this, and I think that there's some confusion because it is true that intermediate rates of immunity in a population under certain circumstances can contribute to the evolution of new variants that are more transmissible and sometimes that are more severe. But really what the virus wants to do is to be able to spread more easily. It's not necessarily trying to become more severe. And I know I'm speaking as if I'm giving this virus agency, but that's, you know, roughly speaking, sort of, you know, we can talk about the evolutionary things that lead to that. But the key thing here too is that That happens with natural infection too. I mean, it's not that being vaccinated is going to be any worse than getting infected with COVID. That both of those things are going to select for more infectious variants. And so actually the best thing you can do is get vaccinated, which is even better at preventing infection and severe disease than a natural infection with COVID, because that actually pushes us towards the edge where it keeps the viral population much lower and it gives it fewer chances to evolve. That's very clear. That's true in the chicken study. That's true in human studies that we've conducted, in the modeling studies, that, you know, it's not vaccination per se that's selecting for these variants. It's just the fact that there's intermediate rates of immunity in the population that can select for the variants. And the best way to prevent that is to get vaccinated, frankly. And that's been a very consistent finding across many different studies with different approaches. And so it's, you know, it prevents disease. It prevents the virus from mutating and evolving in the ways that we don't want it to the extent that we're able, especially with vaccines like the ones we have for COVID that do prevent infection. So.
Great. No, thanks. Thanks for bringing light to that. I really appreciate that. You know, I think that might get to the end. Any last words for you guys before we wrap this up? We're good. Well, thank you all for listening. Mark, thanks for coming on and just telling us like what's going on in your world and how you're processing this. And I really hope for those of you who are listening to share this particular episode, because I think more than anything, it's one thing to hear it from CNN. It's one thing to hear it from Fox, whatever, but to hear it from just somebody who is just on a podcast, this is their profession, this is what they're experiencing, to help people who are unvaccinated or hesitant, who are just don't really know what to do, just to hear a bigger picture of the story that, you know, like Mark said, that we don't get to see. It's a maybe unfortunate privilege that Mark has to be able to see, and hope to encourage other people to take the leap, get vaccinated, and help reduce this so that we can live a more normal life. Hope you guys have a wonderful week. Take care, and we'll see you guys next Monday. Bye-bye.